All right, let's move forward with our analysis this hour. And joining me, I believe via Skype, I believe even in Iowa, is our good friend John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine. He is the author of several books, including Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse. He's the host of the podcast, The Next Left. I wonder if that makes him my rival now, broadcasting rival. His latest piece in The Nation magazine is Donald Trump's defense would make the president a king. John Nichols, always appreciate your time, sir. Thank you for taking time to join us.
I am honored to be with you, Mitch, and I will never be your rival.
I don't know, John. You're going, hey, wait, so you're in, I'm going to save this one for another time, John. You're in Iowa.
Yeah.
What's happening in Iowa?
a lot of stuff, to be honest, but amusingly enough, if you can imagine this, because of all the, you know, coverage of the Iowa caucuses, which people are aware of, next Monday, the big Iowa caucuses, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar and Michael Bennett, who are all competing in the caucuses, are not in Iowa, but Donald Trump is.
Interesting.
So go figure. Trump is having a big rally tonight in Des Moines, and it's full, huge crowd. No question that he's got his followers. And so it's this fascinating dynamic that, of course, for Trump, it doesn't much matter. He will undoubtedly prevail in the Republican caucuses on Monday. For the people who it does matter to, because there's a very competitive Democratic race, a substantial number of them are stuck in Washington.
They're stuck in Washington. John, do you think, I guess we're going to put this to a test now of how important it is physically to be in a state before there is a major vote, or of course this is a caucus. Is this going to hurt Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren? Is this going to help Joe Biden?
Well, that's the billion-dollar question, right? I mean, we don't know the answer. I think that it's a weird thing with Biden. Right off the bat, on one side, he is in an unprecedented situation. He is literally a major topic of a wall-to-wall national news story that isn't about him, right? He comes up constantly as regards the Trump case, the Trump impeachment. And of course, that is because at the heart of it is the president's effort to get the Ukrainians to investigate the Biden family. And so he comes up a lot, and it's a question of, does that help him or does that hurt him? I mean, ultimately, is it beneficial to be seen as the guy that Donald Trump wanted to harm, as is obviously the case, or is it beneficial to be one of these other candidates who, you know, Trump doesn't like, but at least the president, you know, hasn't dragged your whole family story out. We're going to find out a little bit about that on Monday. Now, as regards the other candidates, Mitch, now that's where it gets interesting, because the other candidates are using this in different ways. Obviously, they're flying in whenever they can, and they'll be in some weekend, to be sure. Some of what happens in the next day or so is going to be really telling, because it's a question of, does the impeachment trial go on hold for a little bit? You know, let's say they did decide to have witnesses. I don't necessarily think they will. But if they did decide, would they go on hold to prepare for the witnesses? Might that then allow Sanders, Warren, Klobuchar to fly out for more time in Iowa? We're going to find out a lot tomorrow as regards not just impeachment, but the Iowa caucuses.
That's right. Well, furthermore, I mean, we could go several ways, right? I mean, let's say they don't have witnesses and they vote that down tomorrow. Doesn't mean by tomorrow night they may by tomorrow night then have a vote whether or not to acquit Donald Trump, but it could also go into Saturday, which would then force those senators to be there.
I doubt very much that they would move to an immediate vote to acquit. There may be a substantial number of Republicans who want that, but my suspicion is, and this is cynical me, my suspicion is that the Republicans who want witnesses if they end up having to live without witnesses, part of the deal will be to have a dignified conclusion of the thing. And I think a dignified conclusion of the thing probably involves at least some day or so set aside for debate, i.e. the, you know, the senators all get to spout off a bit about why they're voting to remove or not. So I, you know, again, I could be proven wrong in a few hours, but my gut instinct is that this will carry on probably a couple more days, even if there aren't witnesses.
Really?
Now, the weird, well, yeah, because I think, don't you think that, you know, do you really think Lindsey Graham's going to let this go without a speech?
Well, I mean, my understanding is that would be considered deliberations, and so that would not be broadcastable. It would not be open to the public.
No, I disagree. I think it's a debate before. Well, you're saying jury deliberations. I understand what you're saying. And this is all for interpretation, right?
Yeah.
But my gut instinct is that would definitely go in the congressional record.
Yes.
Ultimately. Well. And this is a historic moment, no matter what we think about it. I would hope that senators would have something to say.
Well, what happened you'll remember 99 better than I will. Now, I was an adult in 1999, so I don't mean to, you know, underplay this, but I wasn't a journalist yet, and I wasn't covering the Clinton impeachment closely at the time. Did they actually have an open broadcasted debate amongst senators?
Now you're really taxing my memory here too. I believe they certainly had, you know, there was certainly wall-to-wall coverage, and I think there was some. You know, I remember now. I've got to really wrestle with this now. I apologize. We should all go to the history books on this one. That, you know, because remember that Arlen Specter had to explain why he was going to be voting against removal of Clinton based on Scottish law. Do you remember that?
No, not as well as you do.
No, it's wonderful. It's one of the great moments in American history because Arlen Specter, who was a former prosecutor, a lawyer, actually a very skilled lawyer, he was also a kind of a liberal Republican. And he didn't want to remove Clinton, and he didn't want to go with the other Republicans. That'd be politically very bad for him in Pennsylvania. So he wanted some reason, but he needed some way out so he could kind of like cover all his bases. And the where he ended up was there's a thing in Scottish law. That is, and I may not say it exactly right, but it's essentially that the case against the person has been proven, but they're not guilty.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
You remember he had this, like, he threaded this needle here. And so there was clearly, you know, like kind of later stage deliberation. But again, that's not, the 99 precedent is irrelevant, as is the 1868 precedent from Andrew Johnson. Those are irrelevant. You have a judge in the, you know, a presiding judge in the room. That is John Roberts. And John Roberts can make determinations in that regard. And I've heard all kinds of speculation about, oh, they might do this, they might do that. There's precedent here, there's precedent there. You know, Roberts, this is going to be, you know, something that Roberts sorts out. Again, I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I really don't. But what I can tell you is that I think it would be politically dubious to simply say no witnesses. Okay, let's have a vote on acquitting. My bet is that just for appearances, there's need for, you know, whether it's closed or open, however it's done, some sort of deliberation, some sort of discussion. Now, here's the other pressure on it, though. I don't think Mitch McConnell is sitting up late at night worrying about Bernie Sanders' candidacy, right? It's not my impression that he's fretting about whether Amy Klobuchar will get extra time in Decorah, Iowa. What Mitch McConnell is worrying about is Tuesday of next week, which is the State of the Union. And it is his passionate desire to have this thing done before the State of the Union so that Trump can do a triumphal appearance. And so it theoretically, you could have activity on Saturday and Monday and still get this thing done on Mitch McConnell's schedule, on his schedule.
Well, what a State of the Union address that would be.
It's going to happen either way, brother.
Well, it's going to happen either way, but the day after, or man, who knows, maybe the day of acquitting the president.
If they take a break in the trial to have a State of the Union address?
Or
in front of the jury.
I mean, we've had, you know, President Clinton gave a State of the Union during the Senate trial, but he never mentioned the trial during his State of the Union. That's my understanding.
He was on a different kind of timeline because, you know, the Senate just was operating in different ways in those days. I mean, it wasn't the McConnell kind of game that's being played here.
But my point being is I just have a hard time seeing this president, Donald Trump, if he's acquitted by the time he gives that State of the Union address, of just ignoring that as well.
No, come on. I think Donald Trump comes in like it's some sort of Rocky movie thing, right? You know, like where you're coming out into the ring, you know, he's wearing like some sort of big, like our James Brown. I don't know. You know, like I have no idea what would happen. But it just seems to me that his behavior, I can't imagine him doing it in a dignified way. Maybe I'm wrong, you know.
John Nichols, I want to get to the heart of this new article that you've written for the Nation magazine, and also just recognizing you're in Iowa covering a very important caucus for Monday, and we're extremely thankful to you for taking time as you're there to join us for this hour. You write this in the article: the argument against impeachment by Trump's team proposes a super presidency, an unlimited and fully imperial leader that could rarely, if ever, be checked and balanced. Tell me about that.
Well, that's the heart of the matter. And it's funny that appeared today, late last night at the Nation site. And I actually wrote that before Alan Dershowitz got up and essentially said later stages that, you know, he didn't think a president using his office to kind of warp the election processes of the United States was an impeachable offense. Now, Dershowitz has tried to walk that back a little bit, but not much. And so he put it over the top. But I was really focusing on things that Patrick Philbin, who is really one of the more mild, quiet, suit and tie, dignified, if you will, of the Trump lawyers.
I mean, he almost comes off, away the actual words, he almost comes off like Mr. Rogers.
That's right. And that's why they made him almost the lead lawyer. He clearly also is the guy who knows the case better than anybody else. I don't know if you noticed that in the questioning, you know, Jay Sekulow, who had kind of been the lead, was really kind of moved to the back, and Patrick Philbin pretty much was answering most questions, or at least a lot of them. So he's really more of center of this than I think he's been given credit for. And remarkably enough, he made, in my opinion, aside from Dershowitz's kind of crazy talk, he made the most startling and jarring argument. And it is my view that if this argument holds, if the Senate, you know, kind of nods to this and respects it, that it's a very dangerous precedent. Because what he said was essentially, you can't hold this president to account because the House didn't do its job. And the House didn't do its job because it didn't go to court. It didn't, bring in all sorts of other avenues here to advance this. And essentially, his argument was that the impeachment power outlined in the Constitution, which is in the Constitution, you know, the sole power of the House to impeach, he argued a radically different interpretation of it that would essentially suggest that, you know, while the House has the power to impeach, it doesn't really have the power to do it on its own. And if the president refuses to cooperate with the House, then the House has got to go find other avenues to try and make him cooperate, maybe a, you know, judicial avenue, maybe they just can't do it. And that's not ever how impeachment has been understood. Impeachment has always been understood that the House, if it launches an impeachment inquiry, has the power to compel cooperation. And while the House has in the past gone to the courts and sought support in that, the courts have found overwhelmingly that, yeah, this is the House's power. And Philbin was arguing something very different. And then he moved finally to an argument that was especially startling to me, which is that if you accepted this impeachment, if the Senate approved this impeachment, then they would be making the House superior, making the Congress superior to the presidency, to the executive. And Mitch, I would argue that is exactly what the founders intended. They gave the House the impeachment power so that it could be the superior of, or at least the checker and the balancer of the president, and then in combination with the Senate,
yes,
capable of creating a process to remove.
I've heard this. First among equals. And the reason is because the House of Representatives has the power of impeachment, has the power of the purse strings, and has the power to declare war.
And, well, in the House and the Senate, right? You both of them are in
Congress.
Here.
I'm sorry, Congress. I should have said Congress.
We're really talking about the Congress.
Yeah.
But here you had Philbin trying to separate the House and the Senate and to really disempower the House. And this is a deeply problematic argument because, taken to its conclusion, we end up in a situation where a president can essentially stop.
Oh, John, we have you breaking up, sir.
Uh-oh, how am I sounding now?
We just got you back, but we had you breaking up a little bit there. You were sounding good before.
I know you get scared about those things.
So don't move,
I think,
sir.
I'll be fine.
So don't move.
I'm at your service.
So, you know, we're talking.
You understand my point here.
Yeah, well, I mean, I want to dive into it more. Patrick Philbin, again, deputy counsel to the White House and the guy who's been making most of the arguments during these 2 days of questions from senators. When he made this argument that you were talking about, it really piqued my interest, especially about the House of Representatives. Again, this, and again, in the Constitution, it says that the House has the sole power to conduct impeachments. And he made the argument, though, that does not mean that suddenly there's no check on the power of the House. If the House, if all it has to do is say that it is conducting an impeachment, and now it can do basically within under the umbrella of an impeachment, in the realm of impeachment, it could do whatever it wants, and there's no one, not the courts, not the White House, there's no one who can tell them they can't do that. And it gives them this dangerous, unlimited amount of power.
But it's not an unlimited amount of power. That's the problem with that argument. Why was this power initially rested with the House by the founders of the American experiment?
You're asking me?
Yeah.
Or did you just break
up
again?
You're a smart guy. No. You're a smart guy.
Why did they give it to the House?
I
would assume because it was really, at the time, the only truly democratic body in government, because you have the Electoral College for president, and then you still had, at the time, originally, legislatures voting for senators.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
There was only one institution that was directly responsive to the people of the United States. And thus, that, you know, in the Jeffersonian concept, that, you know, you rest ultimately, because politicians can be corrupted, all politicians can be corrupted, that you rest the ultimate power with the people, right? And so Jefferson, not being at the Constitutional Convention, but Madison, his, you know, basic sidekick and in that case, you know, advocate for that view, backed up by George Mason and a handful of others, who were very distrustful, by the way, of government. And so they wanted some avenue by which you could prevent a president from becoming a monarch, using his power to maintain that power. Remember, they didn't have term limits on the presidency in those days. They wanted a way to really check and balance it, and they rested the power with the House for two reasons. Number one, the House was democratically elected, not in any sort of appealing definition of democracy. Remember, we had a very, very narrowly defined democracy at that point. It was white guys, you know, with property. So let's, you know, let's not overly romanticize it. But even in that context, at least that was where they erred. And then there was a second reason that it was rested with the House. And that was the House was elected every 2 years, right? President, 4 years, senators, 6 year terms. And so you had this concept that, that, you know, if the people were really objecting to a president, if a president was really dangerous and lawless, you could, in the middle of a term, have the midterm elections, elect a new House, and that House could hold that president to account. And, you know, weirdly enough, Mitch, we did. That's exactly what happened in 2018. Control of the House of Representatives shifted. You had a Democratic majority in this case, which was empowered to hold this president to account. It's sort of, not precisely, but sort of working like the founders intended. And Patrick Philbin got up there and argued at great length that this was illegitimate. And we should be very conscious of that and a little bit scared.
We are speaking to John Nichols of The Nation magazine. His latest piece is called Donald Trump's Defense Would Make the President a King. You can find it online at The Nation's website. I'm going to give out two phone numbers now, and one will be really the last time until the end of the hour and the end of the show so that we don't confuse phone numbers. One is, again, we're passing the hat around. Sometimes you got to do it several times for folks to start chipping in a little bit to help us pay for these broadcasts. They do take resources. We don't use very many. We do a lot with very little, believe me, in trying to do these throughout the entire day. And so what we are going to do is pass around the hat, ask you to chip in what you can. That phone number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org. These broadcasts, again, you know, they only occur through support from listeners like you. So, again, to have these kind of conversations that we're even having now with John Nichols today. Yesterday, we had Frank Bowman on for the hour and dove deeply into the history and theories around impeachment. We've had constitutional scholars and historians on in the week before. And I think this is our strength, really, at least the strength that I hope when we're doing the broadcast, at least that's what we're doing, is trying to make these as educational as possible and understanding them in time and history and also what they can mean for the future. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, online at kpfa.org. Now it's time for the second phone number, and this is so you can get your comments and questions in to myself and John Nichols. The phone number is 1-800-958-9008, 1-800-958-9008. That's how you get your phone call in. 1-800-439. Now I'm confusing callers. Numbers, 1-800-958-9008, 1-800-958-9008. Again, we are with John Nichols. John, I want to talk about this idea of the imperial presidency. And over this past weekend, I picked up Arthur Schlesinger's 20th century historian, though he lived into the 21st century, his book by that name, The Imperial President. And they reissued that book several times over the years. The last time in 2004 with the War on Terrorism, which I thought was really interesting. But he makes this argument that historically, constitutionally speaking, that Congress power rests upon three legs, and those three legs are the declaration to be able to declare war. That's one. The second is the power of appropriation to make the budget, to control government spending. And the third is oversight and investigation. And he makes this argument in 1952, Harry Truman and the Korean War really sort of took away this first leg of congressional authority declaring war. We really haven't had it since, as we've talked about many times over the years. And then he argues that in 1974, when I think he actually writes this book, this is during the Watergate scandal, that Richard Nixon was actually going for trying to attack the last two legs of congressional authority, the spending portion of it, because he stopped actually fully funding programs that Congress had appropriated for. That's why we have this law that we've been talking a lot about called the Impoundment Control Act of 1974 that they basically forced onto Richard Nixon and says that you have to spend the money that Congress appropriates for. That's the law that the Government Accountability Office says that Trump violated by withholding these funds to Ukraine. And then the third leg, again, is oversight and investigations, and that Nixon tried to attack that leg as well, because while he may not have gone as far, say, as Trump has in trying to obstruct the impeachment inquiry, he still did a significant amount, had to go to the Supreme Court to get the tapes, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And in reading that, I just keep thinking to myself, we're sort of having a redo. And hence, one big issue, again, this obstruction of Congress charge, Article 2, which to me seems really important. It's sort of trying to finish off what Richard Nixon was trying to do in the early 70s.
Well, I think that's a concern we've got here. And, you know, look, here's the thing. The presidency, years ago, I wrote about impeachment, and as part of that, I tried to describe the expansion of the powers of the presidency. And that it was, you know, like it or not. When Washington chopped down the tree, they used the wood to make a box, right? And the box wasn't that big, and they put it into it. Handed it off to John Adams, and John Adams tried to grab a whole bunch more.
I hate to do this again, but we're having some major breakups in just the line that we have you on.
Ooh, on our Skype?
Yeah. Okay. I'm thinking, why don't we call you back and just have you on the cell?
Call me?
We're going to hang up.
Totally fine. I'll be ready.
And we're going to call you right back so that we can have you on. Make sure we get to hear him clearly. Again, we are speaking to John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine. He also has a podcast you may want to check out called The Next Left. And his latest piece in The Nation magazine is called Donald Trump's Defense Would Make the President a King.